Thanks for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. We have a brand new season, brand new show, and we've got some incredible guests this year. Our first guest today is General David Goldfein. He spent a little over 37 years in the Air Force, flying a multitude of aircraft. He started as a commissioned officer right out from the Air Force Academy, ultimately leading the Air Force as the chief of staff. So welcome, Dave. Thank you very much for being
welcome
here.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for using my new call sign as well.
First names only now.
I like to say when I retired, I now go by JD, which stands for Just Dave.
Just Dave. I like it.
After 37 years in the military, I think you could go with that route.
Yeah. Promoted to civilian.
There you go. Say.
Well, thanks so much for joining the show today and making the trek out here. We're incredibly excited to have you. I know the work that you've done in the military in the past and what you're doing today is absolutely incredible. So thank you so much for your service and your continued service as well.
Hey, thanks both of you guys. You know, every senior officer in the United States Air Force that's successful, I think, was raised by a great NCO at some point in their career. That's certainly the case for me. Mm. And so thanks to both of you for your service and leadership.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what inspired you to join the military? Were you come from a family background of it, or you just kind of fell into it? What happened 37 years ago?
Yeah, so you actually caught both. You know, family background and fell into it, okay. Right? So my dad was a fighter pilot, flew in Vietnam, a combat veteran, older brother, younger brother. All three of us went to the Air Force Academy.
Okay.
I'm in high school, you know, back in the late 70s in Ramstein, Germany, where my dad was stationed. And I'd applied for the academy because my older brother was there, and it was sort of the natural progression of things.
Sure.
And all I remember is getting a rejection letter, and this is before, you know, email, right? So this was like one of those mimeographed, right, pieces of paper, and it said, you know, thank you for your application. You were not selected because, and there was all these boxes, you know, leadership, military, academic, you know, sports, and all I remember is every box was checked. Oh. And so I thought, hey, nah, no worries, right? Mm. So I applied to University of Wyoming, where my best friend was going, and paid tuition, and I was going to study forestry and be a, you know, a backcountry ranger, you know, and take on music, right? Yeah. It's all my passions.
Sounds like a good life.
And I was bagging groceries at the commissary at Ramstein, and I get a call, and it's some guy from the Air Force Academy. And he says, hey, this is Lieutenant Colonel Jackson. I'm just trying to figure out if you're going to take this school, prep school scholarship that we offered you. I said, well, I've never heard anything about it. Turns out they sent it to, you know, an aunt in New York who never forwarded it.
Oh.
He said, well, this is a preparatory school to help you get, you know, another shot to get into the academy. Are you interested? I said, well, gosh, I'm going to University of Wyoming with my best friend. I've already paid tuition, so no, thanks. He said, well, you better want to talk to your folks and then, you know, and let me know. And I said, well, I'll talk to them, but I'm going to Wyo. Mm-hmm. And at dinner that night, I'm talking to my dad and my folks over dinner. And I said, hey, I got this call from this guy at the academy, you know, who offered me this prep school scholarship. And I told him, you know, nah, I'm going to go to Wyoming. And my dad looks at me, you know, with steely blue fighter pilot eyes and says, so let me see how I got this right. Somebody you called today and offered you money to go to school, and you said, no, I'd like to use my money to go to school. Why don't we call the academy back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So therein lies the, as you captured it, military background and fell into it.
And then just fell right into it. So what does this preparatory school look like?
It was a very small school. There was not that many students, only about 50 of us. It was in Mound, Minnesota, on Lake Minnetonka, right next to the Tonka Toy Factory. If you all both remember that growing up, Tonka Toy Trucks. And we, you know, basically studied all those elements of, you know, what would help us with the application process, primarily a you know, the SATs, right? The scores. I think I took that doggone test about 10 times.
It's a terrible test.
But it took me 10 times to get, you know, the minimum. But it worked.
C's get degrees.
So that set you up for the academy. And how long was that school?
It was 1 year.
One year, and then pretty much smooth sailing after that into the academy, or?
Of course not.
Yeah, so, it's always got to be difficult.
So after 2 years, the academy and I made a mutual decision that, let's just say I was not doing all that well academically or militarily, but at least, you know, athletically I was slow. Mm-hmm. So we just made a decision that maybe I need to go get my act together.
Yeah.
And they had this brand new test program. There were 10 of us that were offered the opportunity to leave the academy for a year, go figure out what we really wanted to do. And if we wanted to come back, there was an option available.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so I left the academy after 2 years, got on my 10-speed bicycle because that's all the speeds you had back in 1980, and started riding across the country with the intent to join up with my musical hero at the time, a guy named Harry Chapin, who, Cats in the Cradle, Taxi.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Okay.
You remember those songs? And so I was going to be a roadie with him. And that was the year that he had his tragic car accident. Mm. And so I ended up riding the entire year on this bicycle around the country. And I met, and it was all the back roads of America. And I met the most incredible people who took me in, and so I learned America.
Yeah.
And I came to the conclusion that this country is worth defending. Mm-hmm. And so I went back.
That's amazing.
Wow. So that inspired you, that time to yourself inspired you to go back and serve.
Yeah. So I am the, some say I am the John Belushi of the Air Force Academy, right? If you remember the Animal House, 6 years.
Yeah, the 6 year program.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Well, you said you were stationed, or your dad was stationed at Ramstein previous to that. So, had you spent much time in the U.S. as a child?
You know, I actually spent most of my time growing up in Europe.
Did you?
We were in England, Spain, Germany. So, most of my formative years were actually outside the United States. Okay. And that's part of why I thought, if I'm going to commit myself to a lifetime of defending this country, I probably ought to know this country.
Exactly, yeah. So that afforded you the opportunity to really get to know it on your own terms.
Right.
Oh, that's great. It's an interesting program. I don't think I've heard of anything like that happening still to this day.
They still have the program. It stopped for a while.
Okay.
And it morphed from the, we're going to take folks who maybe have some potential, mm-hmm. to let them get their act together.
Sure.
To a, this is a competitive program. We're going to let the best out.
It's even more competitive than the Air Force Academy.
Well, and then rightfully so, at some point, the leadership of the academy said, wait, what are we doing? Yeah. What's the purpose of letting our best and brightest out? Mm-hmm. And then the potential of losing some of them.
Exactly.
Well, that was never the original intent. Mm. And so I'm not sure the program still exists today, but certainly for me, it saved a former chief.
Yeah.
Or a future chief.
Yeah, it worked.
That's great that you found yourself into that program. Now, I have to ask, coming from a military family, specifically your father, that's huge shoes to fill. What part of that inspired you to join? I mean, it seems like you kind of made that decision on your own, but there's got to be a huge piece to that as well. I mean, your father served, probably implemented a lot of military into your family, and growing up like that either pushes people away or brings them in. So where did you fall in between that?
Yeah, one of my most formative experience was I was in ninth grade. We were stationed we were in Montgomery, Alabama, where my dad was going through Air War College. Hmm. And that year was the year that the POWs came home from Vietnam.
Okay.
And those that had risen in rank while they were in Vietnam as prisoners needed to re-blue. So all of them were in my dad's class.
Wow.
And they used to come over to our house on Friday nights And my brothers and I would sneak in, you know, and sort of listen to them tell their stories.
Mm. Wow.
And I just remember, you know, being really inspired by the sense of brotherhood, camaraderie, bravery, you know. I mean, and so I always thought, boy, this is a family I'd like to be part of someday. Mm. It's been fun when I became, you know, vice chief and chief and got a chance to go to the Freedom Flyer reunion and talk to these folks, these same folks who were in my house, you know, mm-hmm. all those years earlier.
Inspiring you, yeah.
You know, I would tell them, I'd say, you know, I'd offer you two things. I said, number one, you know, who knew that, you know, your stories would inspire a young man to grow up one day that, you know, to become chief of staff of the Air Force. And I said, and number two, you really shouldn't have given me that beer. I was in ninth grade.
I mean, that's incredible that you got to reconnect with them after all that time. And what was kind of the response to that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of laughter. And they're, you know, one of the things about the Vietnam generation that I've always found inspiring is, you know, I met so many folks who had gotten shot down, you know, over Vietnam, over Laos.
Sure.
Rescued. And you know what they did afterwards?
What's that?
They went back to work. They just got back in the air. Mm. Next night.
Yeah.
No book tours, no big publicity thing. Just, hey, you know, part of the business and back on the horse. And so I thought, you know, as you know, for me, it was a great lesson in humility, you know, to make sure that when things happen to you, you know, you just get back up.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept from what we're looking at today with all of the mental health aspects that are in the military as well and not having access to that in the Vietnam era. So seeing that difference is quite substantial. I think there's an oversensitivity on our part nowadays, as opposed to then. It was just like rub some dirt on and get back in the cockpit.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, after my shoot down recovery experience, they came to me immediately and said, "Hey, really, we want to do a story on this," and I told them no for a year. Mm-hmm. And then it was my way of sort of quietly honoring the Vietnam generation by acting as I saw them act. Yeah. And then I got a call from a very high level in the Air Force that said, "Hey, listen, if you were ever going to tell your story, then the folks that you know really could do a good job of it would be, you know, Ted Koppel, you know, on ABC Nightline."
Sure.
I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember that when he was on there. So I agreed and I said, "All right, I'll tell you what, it's been a year. If you keep me anonymous and you tell the story through the lens of my rescuers, I'll participate."
That's amazing.
So they sent a team out and you know, set up a system very much like this.
Sure.
And at one point the producer of the show said, "Listen, we want to do this part of the show. It's really important that the audience, you know, see that you're part of this. So we're going to put you in silhouette, which sort of black you out. And we're going to have your voice and we're not going to put the name up, you know, and that way we can accomplish our objective." And I said, that doesn't sound right, but man, I'll tell you what, can we do like a small segment, take a look at it and see, you know? And then I said, because my worry is, you know, I'm a commander, you know, in the United States Air Force, and you're going to make me look like, you know, some cheap, you know, mob person on background, right? And he goes, no, it'll be very professional. And so they set everything up. We ran about a 5-minute kind of script, and then we both stood back and we're looking at this blacked out, you know, screen with me talking, and he stopped. And he looked at me and goes, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Well, let me ask you." I said, "What do you think?" And he looked at me and he said, I think you look like a cheap hooker from the mob. I said, yeah, me too.
Feel the same.
It didn't quite work out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
So how did the rest of the format go then?
Great. They called it Pilot Down. Mm-hmm. It was a series. Jeremy was in it. Andy Kubik was in it. Ronnie Ellis was in it. Ryan Denahan. I mean, I think we had the whole crew had, you know, speaking parts.
Sure.
And the what I loved about it was they were on. They were there. It was their story. And then my part of it was really just sort of color commentary, mm-hmm. right? That made the story be all through, you know, their lens. So I was pretty happy with it, the way it came out.
That's really incredible that you were able to kind of sit back and allow that story to become something bigger than yourself. I think that it's a hard balance, especially in this world of sharing impact, being able to share a story without hijacking it completely. Mm-hmm. But that story resonates with so many people and it helps spread the message and the word to help people overcome what they're facing. So I think stories are really important, and I think that's a beautiful way to do it.
Well, the good news for them is sort of like this podcast, right? I got the face for radio. So it's, you know, it's much better when there's, right, it's all sound.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to silhouette you out.
Yeah, right.
Nice deep voice on there.
There you go.
So let's talk a little bit about your younger service and coming out of the academy and finding yourself in preparation to getting behind that plane. So what did that look like for you? Was that your first job in? Like, where'd you go after the academy?
So the first thing I did, and the most important thing I've done in my entire life, was because I didn't want to rush, I waited one full day to marry my high school sweetheart. And we got married there in Colorado Springs, and we just celebrated our 40th.
Congratulations.
Anniversary. So best decision.
Made it through the whole.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, she is. And you got to do a full podcast on just her.
Oh, she's absolutely.
Really, really amazing.
And that would be fantastic, actually.
And she has the face for video between the two of us. Yeah, she definitely has that. So we had agreed when we got married that I would do my best to find a first assignment in Texas for her to finish her college. And so we got a assignment to Shepherd Air Force Base, where I went to pilot training. And Shepherd, Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training, just a phenomenal program. Mm. And so most of my classmates were NATO allies from NATO countries.
Okay.
And we all started together, you know, went through T-37s, T-38s, graduated together. And the vast majority of the U.S. students and the European students were going to fighter aircraft. Two from every class were pulled and given jobs as training instructors.
Okay.
To remain at Shepherd as first assignment IPs or FAPES. And I got pulled to be a T-38 instructor. And I was devastated.
Made the wife happy though, right?
All my friends were... You know, all my classmates, and I'd done fairly well. So I was high enough in the class that I should have gotten my first choice. And when they pulled me for instructor duty, I'll be honest with you, I was young, you know, I was a bit self-centered.
Sure.
And I was bitter. Mm-hmm. I was pretty angry. And so I actually got into instructor training before I graduated because I was just trying to get the clock going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I could eventually get to my dream, that fighter. It turned out, as so many things in life turn out, I got the best assignment that night because I flew, compared to my classmates who went into fighters, I flew 500 hours every year for 3 years.
Wow.
And when you are, as you all guys know, right, when you're teaching somebody else, you've got to understand it at a different level. Mm-hmm. Most of my students were Europeans, English second language.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to teach them the fundamentals of aviation in a way they could understand.
It's a whole other layer of complexity.
And so my understanding of aviation, my pilot skills, the experience you get just from flying that many hours served me so well. Mm-hmm. And I loved teaching. And Dawn got a chance to finish her degree. She got a job teaching there. We started our family with our oldest daughter that was born there right before I left. Mm. I mean, it turned out to be just a magical assignment, the best assignment I ever could have gotten that night.
Isn't that interesting how things turn out like that? You know, you could be irritated that things aren't going your way, but it turns out that it probably amplified your career quite a bit.
Well, Garth Brooks got it right, right? Thank God for unanswered prayers.
There you go. That's it. So you wrap up your FAPE assignment. Where did you move on from there? What was your first MDS or aircraft that you ended up?
So in Shaw Air Force Base, okay. In the F-16 after initial F-16 checkout.
Mm. And what year is this?
And this was 1987.
87. Okay.
Perfect time for Top Gun. You know,
yeah. That's right.
On fire.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be, you know, again, an incredible assignment. Mm. I was in training to become a qualified wingman.
Okay.
And they started accelerating my training. And I mean, all of a sudden I'm flying like 2 and 3 times a day, mm. which I loved. But on the other hand, I was sort of wondering, what's going on here? Right before my check ride, my DO, Director of Ops, pulled me aside and said, we're going to Oman on a checkered flag deployment. And if you guys remember way back in the day, checkered flag was, you know, every base or squadron had an assigned teammate or partner location. And your job was to prepare to be able to operate either with that country or out of that location. Mm-hmm. And so we did a deployment to Thumb Raid, Oman. And my first hour in the F-16 as a mission-ready pilot was crossing the ocean to Oman.
Wow.
And they accelerated me because they wanted me on that deployment.
No kidding.
Going forward. And it turned out to be really important, since it wasn't that long after that we got the call to be the second squadron to deploy for Desert Shield after Saddam rolled south into Kuwait.
Yeah.
And so having already been into Oman and had a deployment there, it made us as a squadron so much better prepared when we got the call to go for real.
Yeah,
that's incredible. So how was your experience with Desert Shield?
None of us want to go to war. Mm. But if there is a war, none of us want to miss it.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
I think it's just the nature of, you know, who we are, right? Yeah. You train to defend the nation, and if it's going on, you don't want to be, you know, sitting on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we were the second squadron to go, I mean, I was just felt so lucky. And throughout my career, you know, just a combination of luck and timing more than anything, I never missed a single fight that we were in between Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. And so, you know, both Bosnia, you know, campaigns, in, you know, both at the Bosnia campaign, the Serbia campaign, you know, Desert Storm, you know, all of those, Southern Watch, Northern Watch, I got to be part of all of them. Mm-hmm. And so when we went into combat on the first day, all of us were green with one exception. We had one combat veteran in the flight, and that was our squadron commander, a guy named Billy Deal. Billy was a Vietnam vet and had a MIG kill as a lieutenant.
Wow.
And he was the mission commander for day one, our first mission, first combat mission. And we get to the end of the runway. It's time to take off. And all of a sudden, I keep hearing this squeak, squeal. And by the way, I was his number two as a captain, flight commander, having never been in combat. Mm-hmm. And after we're all hearing the squeal, and the squeals get louder and more frequent, and it's time for takeoff, and we still haven't taken the runway, and we're all wondering what's going on. And so finally, I key the mic and said, 1-5, is that you squealing? And then I get this long squeal. I said, all right, squeal long if your radios are out. And he squeals, right? And I said, all right. I said, okay, copy. I said, why don't you take the runway and go get a spare. I'll get us to the tanker and wait for you. Long squeal. And then he takes it, lights the afterburner, races down the runway, peels off to go get a spare. And I end up taking the entire formation of the tanker on. And so, and as you might imagine, there was not a high level of comfort with young Captain Goldfein, non-combat veteran now leading the formation when we were all planning to go in on the wing of Billy Deal.
Sure.
And now it's time to drop off the tanker and push. And the whole formation is formed, and I'm waiting, and we're waiting. And finally, very far in the distance, I could hear, fingers, I'm on my way. And I said, boss, is that you? He said, yeah. He goes, hold on, I'm on my way. He gets to the tanker and, gets on. And then we, boom, on his wing, all in a tanker. I've asked him later, I said, hey, when you got on the boom, man, sir, how much gas did you have? And he said, I have no idea because I was below the gauge level. That guy, he was not going to miss that flight.
Yeah.
And so we go into country on the first day and we're all wondering, not only what's it going to be like, but, you all can relate to this, right? Your first combat mission.
Sure.
It's the, how am I going to do? Mm-hmm. When I see the enemy for the first time, how am I going to react?
Yeah.
And so here we are, heading in and we get this radio call that comes sort of out of the blue and says, and this is the first mission of the war. And it says, the Iraqi forces have been notified that you're en route. Mm-hmm.
Get the tingles a little bit.
Okay. And then this voice comes on the radio and it's like a guy that's walking in the park. He said, hey, there's AAA, right? 2:00, right? And we all of us stare. And there's these big puff clouds of, in our aircraft artillery there, right? And there was, and we're looking at him going, wow, that's real AAA.
Actually shooting at us.
And then same calm voice goes, hey, SAM launches left 10. And sure enough, there's this big SA-2, that they're launching up at the formation and they're exploding above us, right?
Those are telephone pole size.
Telephone poles. Yeah. So you can actually see them, right? And so we're looking at that. And then I hear a splash, MiG-29, right? And one of the Eagles had, and because I was far enough in the formation, I saw the Iraqi airplane hit the dirt and explode.
Wow.
I remember that moment in my cockpit when all of a sudden this confidence sort of flooded my cockpit when I realized none of this is new. I've actually experienced everything I'm experiencing here, with the exception of that airplane hitting the ground. I've seen all of this at Nellis Air Force Base at Red Flag. Mm. I've seen AAA. I've seen SAM launches. I've seen this formation. I've heard these radio calls. I've seen them. And you know what? Combat's easier than Nellis. And I remember just thinking, I'm ready. I can do this. Mm. So we went in, we hit the target. Everybody got home. I remember in the debrief, we're all sitting there. And we all came to the same conclusion. Man, it's just like Red Flag. Just like Red Flag. I've used that story over the years, especially when I became chief, to say, what Red Flag produced was confidence under fire. Mm. And that's what we owe young. And so, that was a big emphasis area for me as chief was, hey, let's do for this next generation what the Vietnam generation did for me.
Absolutely.
And that's incredibly powerful. Now, for me, you definitely get that confidence booster in your first mission when nothing goes wrong, right? React to contact, blah, blah, blah. You feel on fire. You feel invincible. But for the most part, for myself included, in talking to an ample amount of individuals, It's when you lose someone that reality strikes in of war. So is that similar for you as well? I mean, that confidence is 100% and then something happens, whether you lose an aircraft or, you know, target doesn't, you know, mission doesn't go quite as planned. How'd that look for you?
You know, I mean, throughout the war, from the air war into the ground war, mm-hmm. you know, there were, I think we can all experience this, right? There were some missions that were just great, some missions that were sort of so-so.
Sure.
And some missions that were just lousy. You know, either we didn't get the job done for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you know, the human element got involved, lousy weather, you know, or something that happened that just, you know, caused it, right? We ended up losing one of our squadron mates, Captain Dale Cormier, probably about a month and a half, 2 months into the campaign, I guess. And we actually lost him, not in actual combat operations, but, you know, he hit the ground, you know, on a recovery at night in the weather, right? Probably spatial disorientation, although we'll never know.
Yeah.
And that was a sobering moment for all of us. But what I remember the most about it, and this might seem, you know, a little bit impersonal to some listeners, but, you know, we didn't pause for a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a job to do.
Yep.
And so we sort of said our goodbyes and then strapped on an F-16 and went to work, you know? And I mean, I think that's just the nature of how we're trained.
It is.
In some ways. And again, you know, in a different setting, in a different kind of an a non-combat operation, we certainly would have taken more time to pause and reflect and, you know, honor Dale. But in some ways, I'd say we honored him by getting back to work.
Absolutely. There's a mission to be done still. There's a special piece about combat aviation that not a lot of people on the ground side are privy to, and that's oftentimes the most dangerous part of combat aviation is yourself, right? Mm. You know, the weather, the terrain and obstacles that are in the way, oftentimes that's what leads to more mishaps than combat-related incidences or being shot down or anything like that. It's something that it's a special piece, and it's hard to overcome sometimes, I think.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see from you if it's similar, you know, in the rescue business, right, or in the special ops business. But I can tell you on my best sorties, if you asked me what I did in my cockpit, I couldn't tell you because that part of the operation was just habit, instinct, and natural. Yeah. My job as a mission commander was to think for 100 airplanes that were in my formation who to have choreographed and timed everything that they're doing, to have run through all the what-if scenarios I could have in the briefing with them and set expectations for what I wanted them to do and to keep in my mind this God's eye 3D view of what 100 aircraft plus enemy aircraft plus what's going on the ground, all of this happening, right? To be able to make, you know, immediate decisions based on, you know, a what-if scenario that happened, right? Somebody who didn't show up, somebody who got, you know, ran short on gas, change in the target area, change in, especially when we were talking about, you know, with ground forces and all of the various dynamic changes that were going on the ground when we were in a supporting role. If I got on the ground and you said, hey, tell me about what happened at this part in the flight in terms of what you were doing in your cockpit, if I could tell you, then I was probably not having my best day. Because if I could tell you what I was thinking about in my cockpit, that means that I had narrowed my focus and I had now had to, you know, sort of stare, if you will, at a certain sensor or sentiment of information, right? And if I was focused inside of my cockpit, I wasn't doing my best job outside of my cockpit.
Sure.
And makes so sense. That's the human element. And when pilots, especially fighter pilots, grow, it's the glass ceiling. And when they stopped progressing is not stick and rudder skills. It's mental skills. Yeah. Can they advance to that next level at the speed of combat and at the volume of what they're going to have to deal with? Can they process that mentally and still be able to lead effectively? That's the hardest thing to do in the business of combat aviation.
Absolutely. And I mean, Sandy pilots and airborne mission commander fighter pilots have probably the most difficult, mentally strenuous job you can possibly have in a combat scenario. You know, overseeing and controlling dozens or you know, 50 plus aircraft at a time with ground forces and enemy movements, being able to have an overarching view of that and conduct it. I mean, that is a challenge.
While flying 600 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And engaging yourself. Yeah. It's
well, and when the stakes are never higher.
True.
Because as a mission commander of a strike mission, the stakes are, did we hit the target or not? Mm-hmm. Mission commander for a rescue, the stakes are, does someone live or die?
Yeah. Every time.
It's a lot of pressure. A lot of pressure. And, you know, I have a buddy, he's an F-18 pilot, and he talks to me about this extensive training that he goes to for mental acuity, like to work on reaction times and drills in that capacity so that you could have that situational awareness and still execute the mission properly. So that's got to be just all around intensive, right? Now you're looking at kind of that 3D atmosphere, so it's not just that 2D plane anymore.
I'm just so happy that there was no direct connection between mental agility in the air and my transcript at the academy.
I was going to ask that. It's like, so how did your, you know, basketball golf game like improve after being a pilot?
Yeah.
A little easier to fly a plane for you.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think that comes from... So you said you didn't perform very well in school. Do you think that just comes from a general disinterest or in having accelerated interests in things revolving around flight, being a pilot? Do you think it was just having something to focus on and pour yourself into that helped you drive that?
You know, honestly, I think as we grow in both age and maturity and through different positions, we tend to have a pretty good sense of what our gifts are and what our gaps are.
Sure.
And I knew, for instance, you know, by the time I became chief, I had a pretty good sense of what my gifts were and a really good sense of my gaps.
Sure.
And one of my gaps is I'm not a detail guy. Mm. I actually dislike details. I'm not a numbers guy. Mm-hmm. I actually dislike numbers. Honestly, if you go back in my medical records, you would find that Cadet Goldfein had psychological desensitization to math anxiety training. Right? Yeah. So what that meant is I had to surround myself with people who were really good at what I was not good at.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so... you know, I think when I was a young student, you know, I was looking for patterns. I was looking for connections. I was looking for how to put it all together, right? And so when there was something that had to do with, you know, numbers and detail, I just didn't have an interest in it. I used to joke when I was at the academy, right? So in every floor of the academy, right, as you went from the second floor, which was the hardcore engineering, to the fifth floor, which was philosophy, you know, and the English, that kind of things.
Sure.
I could predict my GPA based on the floor the classroom was on. I knew I was going to get a D on everything I took on the second floor. And I knew I could counter that with an A on the fifth floor. And so my job was to get a schedule that actually had you know, higher level floors.
Sure.
Right? So I could make it to a better GPA that year.
You were just born for the sky, apparently.
I tell folks today, I said, hey, if you want me to be the guy in the room that looks at a spreadsheet and provides you any value, you have hired the wrong guy.
Well, it makes sense too. I mean, you're operating your career, you know, above 30,000 feet, you know, so you're a bigger picture kind of guy.
Yeah.
And the detail-oriented things are, you know, not going to be your strong suit.
Well, you know, I ended up majoring at the academy in philosophy.
Okay.
And there's this great story that I get a call at the end of my, I had to call my physics instructor to get permission to get married because I knew I had an F going into the final. And I wasn't sure how well the final went. And I called him and I said, hey, sir, it'd be really helpful to me if I knew I wasn't graduating with my class because I got a lot of family coming out. We have a wedding planned. You know, would you just be straight with me so I can at least prepare them? And there was this pause and he said, well, he said, the good news is you're going to graduate with your class. Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
And he said,
huge relief.
And I said, sir, and the bad news, he goes, Cadet Goldfein, you will never come back to the academy as a physics instructor.
Crisis averted. So,
that's all good.
Thank God I'm done with that one, right? Yeah. So you mentioned that you had to surround yourself with individuals that had that strong suit for what you were lacking. How did that translate for you as you progressed in your career with the military? I'm sure, especially when you got up to staff, like surrounding yourself with those that were prominent in their departments was of the utmost importance to you. So what did that look like?
I came to become a strong believer that diversity of thought on your team is a combat imperative. Mm. And that when you're in the middle of the fight and seconds depend on you making the best possible decision, that's not time to try start building a team that's diverse in thought.
Sure.
And when I say diverse in thought, meaning if I hired people and surrounded myself with people who looked, sounded, acted, thought like me, based on a very similar series of life experiences, then there's no way I would see I call them the flesh-colored Band-Aids that were right there in front of me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this lesson came to me from one of my first chief mouse sergeant I had as a squadron commander, Jimmy Kelly. He walked in my office one day and he threw a box on the table. And he said, boss, that ought to piss you off because it makes a lot of your airmen mad. And I said, I picked up the box and I looked at it, you know, and I said, okay, I'm not getting it. What are we talking about here? He goes, well, sir, read the box. I said, Johnson & Johnson, flesh-colored Band-Aids. I looked at it, stared at it. He goes, ought to make you mad. Makes a lot of your airmen mad. And I kept looking at it and I said, all right, Chief, I'm adult. I ain't getting it. What are you trying to teach me here? He says, let me show you. He pulls a Band-Aid out, rips it off, puts this pink Band-Aid on his African-American skin, showed like a beacon, right?
Mm-hmm.
He looks at me, goes, ought to make you mad. Makes a lot of your airmen mad. Mm-hmm. And he walked out. So what's the moral of that story?
Yeah.
I couldn't see it.
Couldn't see it.
Every room I've ever been in has been full of people like me. Right? Every system I've ever competed in, to include most of the systems established at the time for me in the United States Air Force, were built like by people that had the same life experiences like me.
Sure.
For people like me. And so the first, I think as a leader, it's important for us to start sort of step back and acknowledge that there are things in our organization going on we can't see. Mm. It's not that we're fall short. It's not like we're not smart enough. We'll never see it.
Yeah.
Because it's not been part of our life experience. I would have stared at that box of Band-Aids until the cows came home. I would never gonna see it. I'd have somebody on my team that can point out something that was going on in my organization that I had no ability to see. Mm. That's the lesson of building a diverse team around you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're gonna come to the best decisions, you got to have folks that look at a problem and come at it from every different angle.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you start, getting ready to, make the decision, you need to have folks on your team who are confident enough in you as a leader to say, hey, boss, you're about to fall off the deep end.
Mm.
This ain't going to work. I know this is what you're saying. Let me tell you how some folks are going to read this, right? You better have people around you who can tell you that.
Yeah.
Right? So the higher I went in the organization, up through, you know, even up through chief, I made it a point to surround myself, from my personal staff to the immediate staff around me to the folks I hired. I tried hard to make sure that I had people around me who could find the flesh-colored Band-Aids I couldn't see and point them out.
Mm. Absolutely. When you surround yourself with people with similar life experiences and similar upbringings as yourself, you're going to have the same shortfalls and missightings, right? You're going to end up in the same position that you would have always been in. So I think it's an incredible strength to, like you said, surround yourself with people with different life experiences. And I'm curious, from your point, the highest point you reached as chief of staff, and looking back to your point of maybe 04, 05, being a squadron commander or DO level, where do you think the disconnect happens between like a squadron level leadership dealing with issues like that and a more holistic view of the Air Force or the DOD as a whole, right? Because oftentimes leaders are trying to make effective changes and sometimes it just doesn't happen, right? It doesn't happen in the way that you sought to affect those changes, or it doesn't happen in a timely manner. And what's something that we can do as an organization to increase that flow, increase the effectiveness there?
I'm not sure it's as much of a disconnect as it is, you know, making sure that decision authority lives at the right level. Mm. When I came into the job as chief, and I did my own sort of little review of gifts and gaps, and okay, where can I take the Air Force based on what I think my gifts are? Mm-hmm. And what are some areas that, you know, I probably should take the Air Force, but it's just not a strength of mine, right? And I came to the conclusion after working it through with a very small team, led at the time by a young brigadier general, may have been a colonel at the time, Grinkovich, who's now the CFAC, on his way to, you know, hopefully becoming the J3 if he's confirmed. Grinch led a small team, very small team. I had a enlisted member. I had sort of, you know, again, sort of this diverse team. And I was bouncing ideas off of them, you know, before I became chief. And I came to the conclusion that what I knew well was joint warfighting. I hadn't missed a fight. I'd been a support ed commander. I'd been a support team commander. I knew how the Air Force fit on the joint team and a combined coalition team. And so I thought, okay, if I can focus on one thing for 4 years as my litmus test for what I would take on as chief, it was joint warfighting excellence. If I could be convinced that taking this on would make us better joint warfighters, both supported and supporting, I'd take it on. Mm-hmm. If I felt like it was something on the periphery, I would just say, look at it very closely to determine whether we would put any time towards it.
Sure.
And so hopefully you can sort of go back and look at the big things we did and the big areas we focused on and draw that direct connection between this decision and this is the way we handled it and that connection to joint warfighting.
Sure.
So it goes back to the, you know, the disconnect question. The first area I decided to focus on based on my own experience was reinvigorating this essence of squadron command because it is the fighting formation of an Air Force, right? Others have, you know, battalions, brigades, you know, other different kind of the fighting formation that will allow an Air Force to succeed or fail is the squadron. It's the level of command where you actually get to know your people the best.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? Above that level of command, the organization gets too big. It's the level of command where you probably have the best insights from your background on how to lead it. And it's the place at which we generate and sustain readiness. And what had happened at that point, you know, 15 years, 16 years into this fight that we were in the Middle East, it was a very unique kind of a environment in combat because in terms of adversaries, we were uncontested in the air. So we could fly where we wanted, when we wanted, right? We could move equipment and supplies in and out as we saw fit, right? And so When you're uncontested, the unintentional outcome is over time, I was concerned that we had pulled decision up the authority up the chain.
Too high.
And squadron commanders were more in a, you know, asking for permission as opposed to asking for, you know, forgiveness because they took risk.
We talk about this quite often, actually.
Yeah. And so we really focused on pushing decision authority down to squadron command, to focusing on that level of command of you know, establishing a sort of a basic course that now still exists at Maxwell, where we find, you know, young, promising, hopefully majors, right, long before they take the guide on. And we, when we fire them up on this campaign of learning to prepare them for this most essential level of command in the entire service. And so that to me is why I say, I wouldn't say as much of a disconnect.
Yeah.
It's more of a, did we put decision authority where it needs to reside?
Absolutely.
Which is where the individual is in a level of command that make the most difference.
Beautifully put.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we could kind of see that in the corporate world as well, as when you have too much decision-making at a higher level, things don't get done, right? You're, because you question what you could do personally. And I got to report this. So things have a tendency to not get done as well. So I'm sure that is amplified over the majority of the Air Force. So would you say that's kind of it?
You know, I used to tell people at the chief level, I said, listen, you know, everything that hits my desk is hard. And if you ever put something on my desk that's not hard, you're wasting my time and somebody else's.
Yeah.
Because I got plenty of people who can make the easier decisions. Everything that hits my desk is hard.
Sure.
Yeah.
So on most decisions that are not really hard, I don't add value. I just add time.
Yeah.
Because by the time it takes everybody to work it up to get to my desk, we have lost an incredible amount of time. Yeah. And by the way, if it's not a really hard one, I'm not adding any value.
Do you see like a telephone effect happening as well, as something that gets pushed down by your desk? You send it all the way down to the squadron level, and all of a sudden it's completely convoluted and not the objective that you originally had sought out.
You've got to have a way as a leader of you have to have your own way of ensuring that the messaging is happening, right? And at all levels. And so I developed, you know, in my travels, you know, a way of trying to connect. You know, I told my staff, and we didn't always get this right, but you guys will appreciate this because I'm not sure you were on the receiving end of it. I said, let me tell you what's a F when it comes to a visit for me to a base, pulling up in front of a hangar and seeing a formation of airmen waiting for the chief. F. I said, not even a D minus. F. Why F? I said, because I've been in that formation. They've been there for 30 minutes at least, sweating in that formation, right? The first sergeants, you know, God bless them, are making sure that all the uniforms are perfect, to folks who probably are, you know, slugging it out, you know, in a greasy t-shirt most of the time, getting the job done, right? And so the chief pulls up, and guess what? I'm facing an audience that's pissed.
Yeah.
Oh, how's that going to go? Yeah. Right? I said, F. All right, so here's an A. Give me 5, 6, 7 airmen, you know, who haven't been prepped, you know. And I said, I know it's hard to do because, you know, chief's the chief. I said, but the ones I love are small, intimate, you know. And then, man, when you have those discussions, you got to have staying power. Right? You got to, because the first answer to the question you get is always, almost always, what they think you want to hear.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. How things going? Oh, so they're great.
Yeah.
Great.
No really? Improvements needed.
Oh, and what can I be doing for you? Hey, sir, we got it, man. We're good. You know? And you say, okay, all right. Now, we got through that stuff. I know it ain't great, you know? And I know there's, and look, I'm the fix-it guy. You got one shot. And I'm going to protect your 6, right? I mean, would you, you know, digame, right? Would you really talk to me here? I mean, tell me, you know, when I leave this room, you know, and y'all are talking to each other, or you're back in the dorm, or you're at the DFAC, or you're wherever, and you're talking about, man, oh man, if we could only fill in the blank.
Yeah.
I said, you know, and there were times where they told me stuff that I thought, okay, I'm not sure how I can protect their six on this one. And for the most part, to be honest with you, those I handled either very sensitively or not at all.
Sure. Yeah.
Because the risk to them was much greater than the value of what I could have brought together.
Sure.
And then we would just sort of take it on a more broad level that could not be connected to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I love those conversations.
Yeah.
You know,
is there a lot of those types of conversations that gave you some interesting ideas to go back and effectively make
totally.
Change?
Mm. Oh, totally. You know, I mean, I remember seeing a young woman headed off to combat. And I just asked her, because she was going through stuff. I said, hey, you know, this is an opportunity for me. I said, if it's not, you know, too intrusive, can I, you know, can you share with me? Because I've been you know, getting ready to deploy.
Yeah.
And I've seen all the kit I'm putting together. You know, I'd love to see what kind of kit you got. And she said, yes, sir. I'll be happy to show you. She laid it all out. Nothing matched. And nothing fit. We were sending this young woman off to combat, and she's trying to figure out how to make all these men's kit work.
Doesn't right? work?
Vests. There were just, she put her vest on. It was like, you know, way too big.
Yeah, four sizes.
We had, right. You know, boots that she's shoving, you know, cloth into.
Yeah.
You know, that she, and that was one of those, you know, instructive moments where as chief, you can actually do something about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You know what? Not only are we going to fix this, we are going to be the best service of all the services in terms of gear for women.
That's why you guys got the budget.
Well, I mean, you think about it, right? It's, you know, women suffer off in silence, right?
Yeah.
Especially they don't want to big it up.
Well, they
and
say,
there are airmen,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And here we are sending them off to combat with you know,
ill prepared,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's just shameful. Yeah. So we got after it. So that's just one example how. And oh, by the way, this journey never ends,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Oh, I can
if we ever get to a point where we think, oh man, we got this now, it's just great.
Nope.
No, because tech is changing, yeah. Things are changing out there, right? We got to make sure this is 24/7 work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how does that, you know, with the military, I see. One of the strengths and weaknesses is the change of command just happening ever so constantly. How does that affect the processes of these changes and reversing some of the effective changes you're trying to make?
I found that if I could get my thoughts as chief into 1.5 pages and put that out to the command chain, and then as I traveled, just sort of put my own little test on whether the messages got it out.
Sure.
That it was a very effective way of communicating. I mean, I started with, you know, 3- and 4-page stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, when's the last time you ever memorized anything that had more than 3 things?
Yeah.
Yeah. Rarely.
We don't.
Yeah.
Right? So you get 1 page, maybe 1.5 pages, you get about 3 paragraphs. And if you can't, in very succinct, you know, guidance, put that out as a leader,
mm-hmm.
Right? Then, you know, folks are not going to remember it. So it's why I had 3 big rocks, you know, that we focused on. And so we sort of focused on 3s. And I found that if I could articulate, you know, very succinct to the command chain at the right level, right, which was squadron, group, and wing level, then I could rely on those leaders to communicate that accurately, because they could share the chief's words in a way that folks would read them.
Sure.
You know, if I put something out and it was 5 pages long, I said, hey, I expect everybody to read that.
Yeah. Brush it right off.
Yeah. Hey, let's be honest. I wouldn't have read it.
Yeah.
As a guy who's not a detail guy, why would I expect anybody else to read it?
True story.
It's fair.
So for the most part, when talking to higher level military leaders, I always love to ask the question is, what's the job you miss the most? And it always has a tendency to go back to that squadron level conversation, to go back to the squad leader or team leader, whatever it is. Moving up to that leadership level, was that a huge part of yourself that you missed? Is that combat tempo that you were in prior to that?
You know, it's interesting. I wouldn't say I missed it. Mm-hmm. I would say more that I relied on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So because I'd been a squadron commander in combat, that I'd led a squadron, you know, from Aviano, and we flew our combat sorties right there from home, by the way, which is not in the brochure, right? Because, you know, up until the Allied force where we fought from Aviano, mm-hmm. we'd fought every campaign from a deployed location without families. So Dawn and I had a very unique challenge as a command spouse team, right? Because not only was I leading the squadron, but she was leading the spouses.
Yeah.
There was the first night of the campaign, as we were prepping up over, and as and usual for these things on the political end, it was, we're going to go, we're not going to go, we're going to go, we're not going to go, we're working up, working up, working up. And I told Dawn at some point, I said, look, I can't tell you when we get the go order because that's classified. I can only tell you when it's time, a good time to have a potluck. She looked at me and said, I got it. So we get the go order. After I told the squadron, I called Dawn and said, hey, tonight would be a great night for a potluck. And she just, you know, not even bad enough. She says, I got it. Wow. So she invited all the spouses over. And how many do you think showed up?
All of them.
All of them, right? And we're in Italy, so therefore there was good wine on the table.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And I had figured the schedule out so that I could go over and talk to the spouses before lunch. And one of my lieutenants, you know, in charge of the Lieutenants Protection Association, LPA, right? Which I hope is alive and well out there still, right? Had figured out our flight path so we could fly right over my house on departure.
Perfect.
24 F-16s, full afterburner, fully loaded, first mission of the campaign. So I went over and talked to all the ladies who were assembled at the house, and I said, look, you know, I'm not going to underestimate the stress that you're under right now. All I can tell you is that your husbands are prepared for this. Mm. We've been training for this for months. We're 100% ready. And I'm going to bring them all home to you. And we're going to fly over the top. And I said, and I want you to know who's in what airplane. So probably, you know, again, the security officers are probably still in therapy, right? But I handed them a list and I said, hey, whenever airplane comes over, here's who's in everyone. So, you know. And Dawn tells me the story of all of them out there are cheering on the front lawn, you know, raising their glasses of wine as everyone came over. And that's Fingers. That's, you know, Jekyll. That's, you know, all going through.
Yeah.
And their war stories over the years have become better than ours. Yeah. You know, after terms of what we went through. But I'd say, you know, sort of thinking back on that incredible experience I had as a squadron commander influenced the way I led at every level after that. Mm. I didn't ever really miss it. Mm-hmm. It was more of it that I reflected back on it and relied on it. And then when I became chief, it was an obvious place to go in my first big rock, you know, focused on that essential level of command. Mm.
That's got to be a beautiful memory of explaining to the spouses what's going on. And I'm curious, does that hold a certain gravity, giving a speech like that, discussing that with the spouses instead of, you know, the men in the squadron overseeing and I guess, you know, relaying to the spouses that you're taking responsibility for everyone in your formation. Does that hold a certain gravity when you're giving that speech instead?
You know, I wouldn't honestly say it was more gravity. I would say that it holds a very profound positive place as a memory.
Sure.
Yeah, we
enjoy. That's got to be a core memory for you, for sure.
Yeah, especially for those families too. That's something they can look back on and be proud of, I'm sure.
So what year did you retire out?
2020.
2020. Mm. So how are you finding your transition out of the military?
You know, it's been great. One of the things I love is I do a lot of mentoring mm-hmm. of general and flag officers from all the services who, for whatever reason, you know, have learned that I'm happy to help them get started and talk them through sort of what my transition was like and, you know, how do I help them, you know, with theirs. The original two questions you always get, you know, when you're transitioning that, you know, I found, you know, was sort of increasingly irrelevant and irritating over time, right? One of them was, okay, is it job or location? And the second one is, and are you thinking about full-time or part-time? And I said they were sort of irritated because, you know, job or location. Well, right now it's all about location. Yeah. But if I get a good job, could be all about job. Right?
Yeah.
And then the second one was part-time or full-time. Well, last time I was part-time, I was a bagging groceries at the commissary yeah. you know, in high school. Good grief. I have no idea.
It's,
you know,
it's full bore. It's yeah. got to be full bore every time.
So General Joe Dunford, former chairman, was a good friend. You know, and he transitioned right ahead of me, and I remember him telling me about 6 months into his, he goes, yeah, Dave, he goes, here's a much better question to think about as you prepare. A year from now, when people see you and they ask you, hey, Dave, what are you doing? What is a self-fulfilling answer to that question? Mm. That's a really, that turned out to be really helpful to me.
I think that's a great question. It really, it tees up more than just a career. It tees up who you are as a person and where you're going. You closed out a major chapter of your life and it's time to move on to the next one. Your identity is not, you know, being a veteran or the job that you're going to go into next. So I think that's really important into probably what you're implementing is utilizing those skills to create a different world where it doesn't necessarily have a job title on it.
It's part of why the Just Dave, yeah, right?
JD.
You know, I find that this chapter for me, I call it making a difference with people I like. Mm. Yep. And everything I'm doing fits into that category. And there's opportunities now for me to advance on the outside. Mm-hmm. What I was passionate about on the inside and mm-hmm. know that the force still needs. There is, you know, incredible opportunity to make a difference in people's lives. Somebody asked me about 3 months ago. They said, hey, Dave, man, what are you most proud of since you retired? It's a great question. And I thought for a moment and I said, you know, part of the portfolio I built is I'm helping Afghan families get reunited, who got split during the fall of Kabul. And the first family that got me started on this journey was the family of Niloufar Rahmani. Niloufar was Afghanistan's first female pilot. Mm. I met her in 2012 in Shindan when she was flying operationally. And then linked up again with her in 2022 at Maxwell Air Force Base. And she told me what had happened. You know, a brother got shot, survived, took his young family and the youngest sister, escaped essentially to Turkey. They hadn't seen each other for 10 years. She was working through all of the immigration issues. And I said, you know what? I can help. So we formed a small team with a couple of incredible lawyers who have 40 plus years in immigration. And we started working to reunite her family. Man. And we got them out of Turkey 1 week before the earthquake.
Wow.
1 week. And they're all together today and doing just great. Really proud of them. Niloufar was actually just here yesterday. Got a chance to spend some time with her. And so when somebody asked me that question, I said, you know, I'm the most proud of the fact that we were able to get this family together, you know, the way we did. and now we're working on other families to do the same thing. We have one young man, I won't say his name because it's pretty dicey right now. He's within hours of jumping on an airplane. We've been working on this for months.
Wow.
To get him back to the States. And so, you know, making a difference with people I like, that's what it's all about.
That's beautiful. It's a common trend of topics on the Medevac podcast is most of our guests continue to serve post-military service or you know, afterwards. Seems to be a common trend as everyone seems to give back. So I got to commend you for the work that you're continuing to do, especially for the families that have been separated. And it must be incredibly difficult to not see your family for 10 plus years.
Yeah.
To have someone like you step in, it's heartwarming and it's very beautiful.
It does make you appreciate the blessing we all enjoy of being an American.
Absolutely.
Well, I have to ask, since recruiting is just at an all-time low, and I love to hear the opinions of our leaders, is, you know, what are your thoughts on this? You know, we kind of talked pre-show about how we have a tendency, a lot of these nonprofits, to paint individuals as wounded, ill, and injured, and broken, and we project that out to the audience. So in my opinion, I think that a lot of people who see these prominent military characters are injured or missing limbs or something like that. What can we do to change the narrative?
I felt the same way, you know, especially as chief in terms of, you know, how we were talking about the experience of joining the United States military. I remember sitting on an airplane next to a CEO of a, you know, defense firm. And he was talking about how he's, you know, really thinking about his program of hiring veterans and everything. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I can't think of a single reason why you would ever want to hire a veteran. And he looked at me, he said, excuse me? I said, here may be a couple, but other than that, I can't think of a reason why you'd want to do this. I said, well, first of all, they come with a value system because they've been part of something that's much bigger than themselves. So they understand how to commit themselves personally to an objective that's not all about them. They come up with an unparalleled work ethic because they know what it's like to work really hard, really long hours, put in all the time it requires to accomplish the mission and not worry about punching the clock because that's how we do. And I said, and they come with an unparalleled loyalty to an organization because these folks haven't, you know, jumped jobs, right? Yeah. They've stayed in the United States military for some, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, 37 years, right? I said, so you've got this unmatched value system, work ethic, and loyalty. Mm. Man, I can't think of why. Other than that, I can't think of why you'd want to hire a veteran, right?
It's hard.
So, you know, to our young people out there, I think one of our big challenges we're facing is actually been a sort of a slow burn over time since 9/11. Mm. When I grew up, as a kid on military bases, on Friday afternoons, it was intramural day. And I remember as a kid, the whole town coming on base and playing flag football or whatever. And we'd be, and then everybody go to the club afterwards or the whole base would go downtown, right? And so there's this whole, you know, community and right? And, you know, the gate guards, you know, would be just there smiling, waving people through.
Yeah.
Right? And then all of a sudden, Al-Qaeda was behind every bush at every base. Mm-hmm. And what did we do? We put up walls. Yeah. We put up concertina wire. We put up, you know, all of these ways to, and understandably, protect not only our national treasure, the young men and women who were on that base, but also the treasure that was on the ramp. Mm. So I understand why we felt like we had to do it. But what happened was it started over time cutting the links between communities and their Air Force, communities and their Army, communities and their Navy and their Marines, right? And as the separation continued over time, less and less from the civilian population would join the military. Not so much because of a lack of patriotism, but I think it's because it just seemed more foreign.
Sure.
I'm not sure what's going on behind that big wall and concertina wire.
Yeah.
you know, because I can't get on that base, right? And other than the folks from that base that are in the school or in the community or live here, I don't have any connection to them, right? So one of the ways I really tried to focus sort of a reconnection with America was through Garden Reserve. Because if you do a, like a overlay back in the old acetate slide days, right? If you put that little overlay of the United States and say, okay, where's the active duty located? Well, in the Air Force, we're located on the East Coast, along the West Coast, right? Smattering a little bit in the central section, right? And then you put an overlay and say, where's the Air National Guard? Every state.
Yeah.
Right? Live in the community.
Yeah.
Stay in the community. Right? Develop long-term relationships. I was, you know, in governor of New Mexico's office, I remember, and the head of the Taco Guard was there with me. And I'm somebody because I'm, you know, I'm a one-star now, right? And I'm here to meet the governor, and it was a very cordial, it's good to meet you, you know, general, and whatever. And he looks over to the, you know, commander of the Taco Guard, and he goes, hey, he goes, what time are our wives getting together tonight? To go, oh man, I hope they don't do a damage out there shopping today, right? And then he and I talked a little bit more, and then it was back to the Taco Garden. What time's your daughter coming over to babysit? Was that like 6:30, right? And I'm in the room thinking, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
Who is the full-timer and who is the part-timer in this conversation?
Right.
I'm the part-timer.
Yeah.
That's the full-timer.
Yeah.
This is a guy whose wife is out shopping with the governor, whose daughter is babysitting. Those are relationships that we have got to, you know, fully make use of.
Yeah.
And so it may very well be through our Air National Guard and our Air Force Reserves that we have the most effect reconnecting to the American people and sharing with them who we are, what we're all about, and why joining the United States Air Force, you know, is going to help your son or daughter, or son and daughter, right?
Yeah.
Develop commitment, loyalty, value system, all those things that are going to make them successful throughout their life.
I think it's good medicine. It's good medicine, especially in this day and age where we're a little bit more focused on the individualist perspective. You know, being able to be a part of something that is much bigger than yourself, as you mentioned, is very, very important into establishing a good baseline, fundamentals for who you become, especially as a leader.
Amen.
So I want to say, I know we could continue to talk. We're going to have you on next time, next show for a very interesting story. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your wisdom, sharing some of your experience. I mean, an incredible hero to our nation and our military. Thank you for everything that you've done.
Well, thank you guys. And you shared with me when we walked in that you lost your leg in Afghanistan. And I was amazed at watching you run around the house here. So, you know, thank you both for what you've done. Thanks for the officers you've raised. Thank you for being in the rescue business. And thanks for continuing this conversation with America that's so important. Yeah.
Well, I think you nailed it on the head earlier when you said that we have to reflect ourselves as strength for those that are up and coming as well. And you know, my journey through recovery is the same concept, is I push myself hard so that I could effectively help more people and share amazing stories like you so that we could help this country get back onto its own two feet, get some people in the military, and get those great skill sets that they need.
Amen.
So is there anything that you want to say to the audience? Maybe a little leadership advice or just a little tidbit lesson that you've learned over the years?
You know, I never try to leave an organization without thanking spouses and families. Mm. You know, they exhibit just such a very special kind of courage. You know, when they go through a career that often has long hours, you know, defending the nation's hard, always has been, always will be. Separations, sometimes loneliness, You know, sometimes they find themselves like Don did when I deployed so many times, you know, as a single parent. And I don't think we ever do enough to say thanks to them for what they do and the service they provide, a very special kind of courage that our families have out there. So I'd love to leave this by just saying thanks to all of them.
That's amazing. And one of the biggest things that I tell people is that our families, although they're a part of the decision, they weren't the ones that signed the dotted line, but still have to suffer the consequences of the actions that happened because of their spouses or situations that they put in. So it's a special type of strength, but military service nonetheless. Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Go interact with it somehow, like, comment, share. And if you need to get in touch or find General Goldfein, you can find him, General David L. Goldfein, just on Google. You'll find him out there. Thanks very much for joining us today, and we'll see you all next time.
See you next time.
Bye.